8 a.m. having arrived. I'm going to call the taxes committee to order. We do not have a quorum right now, but I am going to present House File 540, so we'll start out with that, and I'll turn it over to Vice Chair Les Legarde.
Yeah, so Chair Marquardt cannot move his bill at this time, but we will hear his bill. Please proceed.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And this does have an amendment to it that when we kind of get the quorum, we can do some official business. But what this bill allows you to do is to use what would be called inconsistent election when it comes to filing your federal and state taxes. And this came back to last year. There was a lot of talk about consistent election, where it was the Department of Revenue's interpretation of the law that if you standard deducted on the federal side, you had to also standard deduct on your Minnesota taxes. And likewise, if you itemized on one, you had to itemize on the other. And last year, if you heard Chair Davids and myself and others talking about how we had to get the conformity done, or it was going to cost about $58 million to taxpayers, this is where the problem was caused. And let me give you an example. So the federal government raised their standard deduction to $24,000, but Minnesota was at $13,000. And so with consistent election, let's say you had $21,000 in itemized deductions. On the federal side, you would take the standard deduction, which is $24,000. But if you were forced to also do the standard deduction on the state side, you would standard deduct at $13,000, therefore losing about $8,000 of income that you otherwise could have deducted. And so just for an example, at the 5.35% rate in this scenario, if you're losing $8,000 in income, that'd be 428 extra dollars you would have paid, all the way up to, let's say, you're a 7.85% marginal rate, that's $628. And so that was kind of the assumption when session ended last year and things were going on. Then in August, the Department of Revenue, in looking at it closely, because the federal government, you know, was such a difference with the deduction, went back and really researched this and found a case. It was the Wallace case that basically said that the precedents from the Minnesota Supreme Court case of Wallace versus Commissioner of Taxation established that the Minnesota Constitution prohibits the state legislature from delegating its power to tax to any outside agency, including the United States Congress. And also, Minnesota Constitutional Article 10 in our Constitution says, the power of taxation shall never be surrendered, suspended, or contracted away. So basically, the interpretation was that the state government can't be bound by the federal government when it came to filing your income taxes, and also it would deny someone on the Minnesota side a benefit that the Minnesota legislature wanted this person to have. So the federal government or the state can't contract away, surrender, whatever, to the federal government. So anyway, in August then, the inconsistent election was allowed. What this bill does is basically clarifies it, puts it in law, and says that if you standard deduct on the federal side, you can come back and itemize on the state side and vice versa. Now, in the amendment that you have here, it says, though, that if you are married couple filing separately, you do have to do consistent. So you couldn't have, let's say you're filing separately, you could put all the deductions itemized into one person. So you have very low, you state the standard here and the other person. So this would clarify that if you're filing separately, you have to use consistent election. So I don't think because it has election, this has to go to government operations or anything like that. I think it just can stay in taxes, hopefully. But anyway, this was the big debate last year, and you know, that was the concern. So I'm open for questions, members.
Chair Davis.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thanks to Chair Marquardt for bringing this bill forward. It's kind of like, and I hope this is in the omnibus tax bill that gets signed, it's kind of like we really mean it because it was there all along. We were told ad nauseum is going to cost like $28 million a year, $56 million a biennium, and then we couldn't do it. Then all of a sudden, the department in August saw the light and said, oh, yeah, we can do it, and we better do it. So we already have the ability to do it, but I like this bill because this is one of the bills where it says, okay, it's already the law, but we really mean it. And so I'm feeling a bit redeemed today. This was a major sticking point last year, and Chair Marquardt was on the conference committee, helped us with this, and the department took a different approach until they saw the light. So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman, thank you for this bill.
Is there anyone in the audience wants to speak before or against this bill, 540? Hearing none, Chair Marquardt.
Very good. When we get thank you, Mr. Chair. When we get a quorum, then we'll make the appropriate motion. So.
Okay.
So thank you very much, members of the committee.
Oh, we do now.
We don't have a quorum yet.
Oh, we do just have a quorum. And so, Representative Petersburg.
Before we get to that, Mr. Chair, I would just like to share with you the authority and power that you just talked about in regards to the Constitution. Chair Davis and I were just chatting. The fact that you can't even usurp and give away that power means that, Mr. Chair, you have the power even over the Ways and Means Chair because you can't usurp that authority. So.
Well, thank you, Representative. I'm standing up straighter, sitting straight. Thank you very much. So, and I also want to, Representative Chair Davids, are those Girl Scouts lemon cookies there?
They are, Mr. Chair.
Those are the best, and the lemons are the best, too. So we
can
thank you for bringing that through. Thank you very much. So we do have a quorum. Do we have someone that would like to move the Tuesday, February 26th minutes? Representative Les Lagarde moves approval of February 26th, 2019 minutes. Any discussion on that? See none. I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion does carry. The minutes of February 26th are approved. At this time, I will move House File 540 for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill, and also at this time I'd like to move the A2 amendment, which I did speak to when I was presenting the bill. Is there any discussion on the A2 amendment? Hearing none, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The A2 amendment, the motion does prevail. The A2 amendment is adopted, and now I will renew my motion to lay over House File 540 for possible inclusion into the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, members. Next bill on the agenda is House File 317. Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair.
1317. Thank you very much. So does someone care to, and we have more goodies coming from Representative Bierman. Thank you very much.
Girl Scout cookies.
Yes, it is that time of the year. I had just purchased some Girl Scouts cookies, and the lemon ones are fantastic, yes. So who would like to move House File 1317? Representative Davids moves House File 1317 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Representative Bierman, welcome to the committee, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I did bring some treats with you. I made a strategic error there, and I saw lemon cookies out on the table, so I left those in my bag, and I got these out for variety. but I just want to invite you to my office. I have tons of Girl Scout cookies. I have a lot of girls I'm supporting right now, so come over anytime. There's plenty there, and lemon, too.
Thank you, Representative.
All right. I'm pleased to present this bill, House File 1317. This bill provides a statewide solar tax credit scaled down to 2023 for residential homesteads, businesses, and farms that install a qualified system. This tax credit will help Minnesotans across the state participate in our state's clean energy transition. Our neighbor Iowa has utilized a program like this since 2012 and spread the use of solar power to every county in their state. Such a promotion here will expand clean energy independence options for communities that otherwise may not make the economic leap at this time. There are not a lot of incentive programs like this in greater Minnesota. In Iowa, over 4,200 systems have been created, resulting in over 800 jobs and helping to reduce greenhouse gases. This tax credit works. Combined with the federal tax credit still available for a few more years, it is just the encouragement many need to get us back on track for the clean energy renewable goals we have. I have a few testifiers, and then we'll take questions. Thank you.
That sounds good. If your testifiers would please come forward. And can come up to, a couple can come up to the table at the time, and the other ones, if they would be seated towards the back. And so first come, first serve. Please state your name for the record, and please proceed.
Hi there. Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives of the committee, for having us today. My name is Liz Lucenti. I'm the program director at MNSEA, which is the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. We're a nonprofit trade group. We represent the voice of solar in the state, the whole state, all the sectors, manufacturers, installers, developers, ancillary service providers. We're really happy to be here and see this bill introduced, and we support it wholeheartedly. And as Representative Bierman said, we look forward to greater Minnesota having more incentive options to go solar. The National SEIA Group estimates that about 60% compound annual solar growth has happened as a result of the federal investment tax credit enacted in 2006. So that's about 1,600% growth in solar installation. So we see these incentives and these credits work. The ITC, the federal ITC, is scaling down. It should be about zero in 2022. And this bill we're very happy about because that cliff is mitigated a bit by the breakdown in the tax credit here. So it's about 11% for that period when there's no more federal tax credit available. And that might help mitigate some issues with a potential lag in development, provide a little more business stability, and also allow folks like farmers and other businesses to go solar. They can mitigate their tax, their energy bill, and go clean. So I know there's a bunch of testifiers from the business community here, and I'll refer to them. I do remain available at MNSEA for any questions about our support of solar issues, and I really thank you for allowing us to testify today.
Ms. Lucenti, thank you so much. Please state your name.
Mr. Chairman, I am Bob Olson. I am a corporate and tax attorney and former bank owner and also currently president of Olson Energy Corporation. Income tax credits are one of the most efficient ways of influencing financial behavior. The administrative cost by the state is nominal, and it is a direct dollar-for-dollar reward, whether you are at a higher income tax bracket or a lower tax bracket, although the difference on our in our top tax bracket in Minnesota and our lowest bracket is very small, as you know, a couple percent, basically. What we would like is a level playing field, subsidy-wise and tax-wise, between fossil fuels and renewable energy and storage. A couple years ago, I spent some time researching the tax benefits for fossil fuels, and they are huge. The federal tax credit for wind and solar, which is scheduled to be reduced for solar and expire for wind, pales in comparison to these tax subsidies that have been in place for decades for fossil fuels. I often ask a question for somebody in the group to name a tax benefit subsidy for fossil fuels. And even though I'm asking renewable energy and other experts, only around 1 in 10 can name even one. I have a famous acquaintance, each of you would know his name, who does public speaking regarding climate issues. I have never heard him speak, but he has said that he will usually ask the audience what they paid for a gallon of gasoline this last week. today would be around $2 or so. He then says that they should add at least $14 to the cost of that gallon of gasoline, making it $16 or so if you calculate the taxpayer subsidies that they are giving as U.S. taxpayers to fossil fuels. He quotes a well-respected study and supports these numbers. As I understand it, other subsidies will range higher or lower. So you're paying $16 per gallon of gasoline as a taxpayer. I recently read Robert Caro's biographies of Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson began his path to power at one point in 1940 by getting significant campaign contributions from the newly rich Texas Wildcatters, which the campaign contributions he distributed to other Democrats who in turn opposed Franklin Roosevelt's and his Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau's intent to get rid of a huge subsidy called percentage depletion allowance, which they thought unjustly enriched New England oil barons. That tax benefit is still in place today, along with many, many others. If you believe that climate change concept is a hoax and a communist plot to take away our freedoms, or a majority of your constituents do, I would suggest that you might want to vote against this incentive for wind and solar and storage. If you're concerned about the climate, or you'd like to have a level playing field between fossil fuels and renewable energy in Minnesota, this is a beginning, and I would suggest you vote to pass the bill. Much more benefits will need to be given to renewable energy, or a lot of the tax subsidies and other subsidies for fossil fuels taken away from them in order to have the desired level playing field. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, members. And I do want to tell members we're not going to be discussing climate change in this committee today, or fossil fuels versus renewables. And I would also ask the testifiers to, you know, we're talking about tax items and incentives and so forth. So, Representative Swiatkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just with the testifier, I forgot your name. Sorry, sir. But, you know, you talked a little bit about tax credits and support. Would you support a bill that would equally support coal, wind, and solar kind of at the same level per megawatt?
Well, I think we already, as taxpayers, we already have much more for coal than we have for wind or solar. So if we're going to have a level playing field, we'd have to take some away from coal.
Per megawatt, sir?
Representative Swiatkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Per megawatt, you would support that?
Mr. Olson.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Olson. Next testifier, please proceed. State your name.
Mr. Chair and representatives, my name is Virginia Rutter. I am the Minnesota Program Director for Solar United Neighbors. Solar United Neighbors is a national nonprofit that represents the interests of solar owners and provides education and technical assistance to homeowners and small businesses as they choose to invest in solar. I have talked with hundreds of Minnesotans across the state, from Winona to Kandy, Ojai County, up to the Iron Range, and there is strong support and interest in investing in renewable energy. And incentives can really make a difference for people in their decision whether to invest or not. And I've had lots of conversations with people about the disparity between the incentives that are available in some utility territories and others that have nothing. So I think House File 1317 would really make a difference for greater Minnesotans who are interested in investing in clean energy. I also have two statements to read from supporting organizations. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance strongly supports a state tax credit to support rooftop solar because it provides financial security for homes and businesses, supports local jobs, and keeps more of our energy money in the local economy. Rural customers have been left out of the opportunity for too long, and this tax credit would level the playing field. And then the Winona Climate Action Network has spoken with numerous southeastern Minnesotans at events and forums in this last year. It is clear to us that there is a great deal of interest in solar opportunities among rural utility customers. It is also clear that solar options are more limited for customers served by small, more rural utilities as compared to those offered by Xcel Energy. Based on our experience and mission, we strongly support incentives for faster, wider development of solar power throughout Minnesota, including rural areas like ours. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Ms. Rutter, thank you so much. Sir, welcome. Thank you. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Jan Hubbard. I'm the owner of a solar and energy storage company in Minnesota, Natural Energy Solutions, and I support this bill. Air pollution from our electric power generation is just slightly less than that from transportation. And these are the two leading causes of greenhouse gases and toxic air pollution in Minnesota. And air pollution is the leading cause of premature deaths on this planet. And this has been documented in a recent report. It's the most comprehensive report to date from the Lancet Commission on pollution and health. Released just over a year ago, it states diseases caused by pollution are responsible for an estimated 9 million premature deaths in 2015, 16% of all deaths worldwide. The World Health Organization says it's over $4 trillion in costs, and which is slightly over 6% of world GDP. In the USA, an estimated $30 in benefits has been spent for or has been received for every dollar invested in air pollution mitigation since 1970. Benefits to the economy have been over $1.5 trillion from $65 billion invested. Opponents to solar energy have complained about cost shifting and cross-subsidization from solar incentives and from programs like net metering, but every power utility in Minnesota is causing and contributing to climate damage and shifting high health care costs onto all of us by polluting for free. The Minnesota Solar Tax Credit is an effective and an equitable way to deliver benefits to Minnesota because we all pay the cost for removing these, for not removing these pollution sources to clean up our economy, our environment, and invest in the fastest growing job sector in Minnesota. Air pollution and climate change is in everyone's backyard. We can invest in a solution now or pay more later. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hubbard. Representative Bierman, do you have any more testifiers?
No, that is all the testifiers I have.
Okay. Then, so I first of all want to, before we go questions, is there anyone else from the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 1317? Seeing none, just before we go further, Mr. Williams, could you explain a little bit of how this program would work?
Mr. Chair and members, so essentially the credit is available either to businesses or individuals. The credit is equal to a percentage of the purchase of a solar energy system, which is defined to include a photovoltaic system, a solar water heater, a solar thermal system, or energy storage. The percentage for the credit scales down over time, so it starts at 15% of the cost of the system in 2019 and scales down to 11% in 2020, and then the credit expires after tax year 2020. The maximum credit for an individual is $5,000, and the maximum credit for a business is $20,000. And other than that, the credit is capped at about $5 million, or at $5 million per year.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe staff could also verify if I read the definitions and who this applies to, it looks like it excludes apartment buildings, apartment complexes. Is that correct, or am I misreading that? Because I don't see that property class there.
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's limited to residential homestead property. So I think that's correct.
But it would
stand at Petersburg.
Thank you. But it would apply to businesses?
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, members, yes. So if you look at the language I'm pulling up, so on line 2.20, it's the credit is capped at $5,000 for solar systems installed in the homestead and $20,000 for systems installed on business property. So it's available to both businesses and homesteads.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's kind of the way I read it, too. So it's good for businesses and and individuals, but not businesses in old apartment complexes or groups in old apartment complexes as well, which I would then ask the author or somebody if that was their intent, and why would we exclude apartments?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think our intent was to get residential involved small businesses or large businesses up to that $20,000 tax credit, but we had tried to steer something away from, say, the community solar at this time. There are some of those programs out there, so we were specifically targeting for this amount of money available in a given year that we wanted to see that go more toward residential and have that choice.
Okay. Yes, so Representative Petersburg, I mean, it looks like classification 3A property and then 1A and 1B, so right, so that'd be CI and then residential.
Yes.
Representative Les Lagarde.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I believe in balance, but my question is more of a labor issue. So where are we purchasing these panels? They're not coming from China, right? They're coming from American-made and also Minnesota. Is that in the bill? I didn't see it.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Les Lagarde, it does not state that in the bill where the panels will come from. That is something that an individual homeowner would need to work out with the contractor. So we're not involved in that negotiation or specifying where the products come from. There are various options. If you wanted to buy a U.S. product from these providers, I think all of them, as far as I know, have those, or at least they did the last time I looked into it a few years ago. You could buy U.S. products or you could buy foreign-made product.
Representative Lestergaard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we're trying to do the right thing the right way and we're using tax dollars and we care about the climate, I mean, we live in a global economy, but we also live in a global environment. And if we want people to use these renewable energies and solar, wouldn't we want a mandate that we know where it's coming from and they're following the rules and the regulations that this country has in this state? So if all possible, we'd want it to come from United States, and we'd want it to come from Minnesota, if all possible.
Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question and highlighting that. That's certainly an issue that when I go out and buy products, I think about that. We do live in a world economy. I'm a small businessman. I have products in my flooring business and in my furniture company that are coming from around the world. In fact, one time I took a globe and I put pin marks on where all my products are coming from. And I was astounded at the lack of U.S. products at this time, especially in the furniture sector. So we are a global economy, but if I have a customer who walks in the door and they want to look at U.S.-made products, I have U.S.-made products. I've made a heightened effort to find them and get them on my floor and offer them to my clients. Far too often, though, unfortunately, I think, it comes down to price. And I have many clients who will come in looking for American-made, and then they will see a price difference, and then they will go with the foreign brand. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that we can necessarily force on people in my line of work. I understand your desire to get a Minnesota product and Minnesota labor, of course, and Minnesota brand. I would love to do that and promote that more. But I think for the effort of this bill, the effort is on renewable energy, and that's the way we're headed.
Representative Les Lagarde.
Well, I appreciate that, but you mentioned the word cost, and we listen to the cost of how it affects people. And if we truly believe that, cost isn't the issue, obviously, right? Because we don't want to do unfunded mandates onto people moving forward. So I would ask that, I don't know if this is going on, but before it gets put in the omnibus bill, that there's an amendment that says that it'll be made in Minnesota or at least in America, and it'll be made by our labor. That's would be an amendment that I would ask at some point. I don't know what the process is.
Representative Slazinski.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe there is a restriction on amendments in this committee, correct? Like, if you wanted to do an amendment, you could do it right now?
That is exactly correct. The only thing is I just want to, I mean, we want to make sure it's written right. So if this makes its way through to the omnibus bill, there certainly, you know, could be an amendment at that point that could be done. But you're exactly right, Representative Swazinski, there is no 24-hour rule, and it's just to make sure we get it right. So any other comments from committee members? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's an interesting conversation. There's no doubt about that. And one of the testifiers talked a little bit about rural Minnesota and says that rural, I believe the quote was, rural customers have been left out for too long. And one of the other testifiers said, I believe it was Mr. Olson, said that he wanted a level playing field. And he talked about wind and solar. In this bill is just solar. Am I not correct?
Correct.
Representative Bierman.
Yeah, Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair, yes, correct. Solar.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you. And then just to be clear, and then Representative Bierman, on page 3 of your bill, it talks about rural electric co-ops. I want to know what your intention is in this bill.
Representative Fabian, where is that?
Oh, I'm sorry. Page 3.5 through 3.7. I'm particularly interested in his application of Minnesota statute section 216B.164, subdivision 3, paragraph A.
3.5.
I think Mr. Williams can maybe help him out.
Mr. Williams could address that. Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chair and members, I spoke with our energy analyst about that language because I was also curious about that. So that's a cross-reference to the state's net metering law. And so for an electric cooperative association to qualify for the credit, a taxpayer has to receive energy at market rate from either a utility or an electric cooperative association, or a municipal utility or an electric cooperative association. And for the association to qualify, it has to be subject to the state's net metering law. And that's what that cross-reference is. And that is the extent of my knowledge of energy policy.
That's the great thing about the tax committee. We cover all the committees. There should just be an omnibus committee that covers just all bills. Representative Fabian. Yeah, I guess we do.
Hi.
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, we call that the Prime Committee then?
That's a sure we can call it the Prime.
So anyway, if you go on your devices, you can go to the North Star Electric website, and that's the rural electric co-op that's based in Baudette, Minnesota. I know those people extremely well. They put up a solar array demonstration, and they spent about $25,000. Its maximum output is 5 megawatts, I believe. I don't understand all this stuff. And you can go and look real time as to what that solar array is producing and take a look at the savings. In the past year, on a $25,000 investment, it's referred to as, they have saved approximately $388.85. Now, if you go to buy a car and you go to the bank and the car is going to depreciate and you're going to tell your banker, I'm going to pay you $388 a year on my note, I don't think that you're going to get very many bankers to take that loan. But what's even more interesting is that when you take a look at it, in the past 30 days, North Star Electric on their solar array has determined that they have saved approximately 4 cents. So I'm not opposed to solar and so forth, but I think that some of these things have to stand on their own 2 feet. And I understand about level playing fields, but I don't know that this does it. I do want to ask one other question. What role would a rural electric co-op or a municipal have in either accepting the surplus electricity from the solar panels or not? I mean, what rights do they have to say, we will participate in this program or we not? Because I'm hearing from my folks that, number one, they're concerned about, you know, the switching and all of the stuff that is involved in connecting these things. Firefighters have concerns about solar panels being on roofs. In some cases, I've heard they will not go on a roof if a house is on fire if there's solar panels. Help me out.
Who would like to answer that? Representative Bierman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll say a few comments and then my testifier may add in. But as far as the electrical issue, we've had testifiers in our other committee say that this is not a big deal as far as electricians, professionals who know what they're doing as far as the system goes. It's not an impediment at all. I haven't heard that about firemen on roofs, that issue at all. I that's new to me. And as far as the your first issue about the performance of a given solar system in operation, I can't comment on that. I can comment on my own system in at my house and how it is working. There are certainly days and times of the year, this being one, winter cloudy days, it's not producing that much. But it goes gangbusters when the sun is shining, I'll tell you that. So it just depends on the particulars on that system and the time and day they're checking it, and month, of course, in Minnesota. It makes a difference. Solar is not the end game that will supply all of our energy needs, but it is an important part, and it's one that we need to work on expanding, and that's the purpose of my bill. Would you like to add?
Ms. Lucenti?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. As for the fire safety issue, I know the Department of Labor and Industry has been revising its National Electric Code to comply with the Minnesota ones and just revamp it so that they're all in unison. And they're, I think, soon going to release a new setbacks requirement for solar on roofs. And they've even said in a couple of meetings at Department of Commerce that sometimes fire marshals aren't even going up on roofs at all anymore, but that's something to check with each locality. As for safety, in Mincia and our trade group, we make sure everybody's compliant with all the codes and ethics and all the safety standards, and we approve those and support them. But, yeah, and also on the this credit, actually, for the business property, that could go to a utility, I think, under the 3A designation. I think that's commercial, industrial, and utility real property. So if they have a storage system at the utility or something like that, also they could benefit from this tax credit, I think. That would be a question, I think.
Let me ask Mr. Williams, is utilities benefit?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Clem has confirmed that utility property would be covered in. So
utility property would be covered. Okay, under 3A. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, any closing comments, Representative Bierman?
No, I think we've covered a lot of ground. I appreciate your time and your questions, and gives us more to think about. Thank you so much.
Thank you for bringing this forward today, Representative Bierman. Representative Davids renews his motion to lay over House File 1317 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Representative Petersburg, we're back to your bill from yesterday that you were cordial enough to allow us to defer it to today. It's House File 1083. And Representative Petersburg, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to move House File 1083. To be laid over with probable inclusion into your bill, but I know you won't let me do that. But so I will do it for possible inclusion into your great tax bill.
Representative Petersburg, very good, moves House File 1083 for possible probable inclusion. So please proceed.
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is not a very extremely complicated bill, but it has been around, and I've been pushing it for a few years, and it has to do with Farm America down in my area, which, by the way, anybody who hasn't been there ought to come down to Waseca. It's just outside of Waseca. It's something that was set up in 1978 by the legislature for actually three different learning centers, one for timber and lumber, one for iron mining, and one for agriculture, just so that we could kind of preserve, celebrate, promote those particular industries, which really are the backbone of the early parts of the state, as well as even into today. And so today they have about 360 acres, and they connect people with the evolution of ag through their centers, through their interpretive center there in Waseca. A few years ago, they went through a audit by the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue determined that they were had been supposedly being charging for sales tax for their admissions going into their interpretive center. They had always been believed as a 501c3 set up by the state that it would have the same benefits as most educational programs. And so they've been doing this sales tax exemption, or excuse me, sales tax collection for that. And they're coming here now just being asked if they can't go back to the way they thought they should be, which means that they are exempt from having to collect sales tax on the admissions going to the interpretive center. It allows them to be able to use those funds instead for improvements, etc. They really are a volunteer-based organization. Board of directors do a lot of work there. They have a part-time staff there to help out with the day-to-day operations, but it's really something that is beneficial to the community, beneficial to the ag department, and something that is very good. And so I'm here just asking for that particular exemption. Ms. Templeton and I talked a little bit over the revenue estimate that was given here, and we both agree that that seems awful high. In talking with Farm America over the last few years, they've never had to remit more than $500 worth of sales tax for that those emissions. But beside that, it is what it is, and I would really appreciate your support.
Thank you very much. Do you have any testifiers?
You know, I don't think Bob was able to make it today, so I do not.
Very good. Well, so let me ask first, is there anyone here in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 1083? Let's see, none. I'm Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious on the at least 115 acres provision, is that, you know, where did that number come from? If that was a different number, would other organizations qualify?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. You know, that was one of the concerns, is that this wanted to make it specific for the organization that was created by the state, and originally it started with, I think, about 120 acres, and so this would really be involved for this specific program. The revisers really are telling me that they can't specify a particular, in this particular one, they don't want to specify Farm America to make it specific, so they wrote it this way, and so I'm just taking their advice.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious how often we've seen this bill over the last 5-6 years. 10 years.
Over
the last 10 years, let me revise my question, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Dalton, how long have we addressed this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, the bill has been introduced every year since 2015. There were some earlier bills, but those were actually dealing with their audit and forgiveness of their tax audit.
Representative McDonald, didn't he?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it's about time we get this passed, since we couldn't get it passed in previous years. Not because of our past chairman, of course.
Chair David, your name was invoked. That leaves us open.
Lovingly, I'm sure. Would the department have any comment on this?
I don't know. Does the Department of Revenue have any comment on this bill? Okay, so we are.
What was that word?
I heard the word Senate used.
Yeah,
that wasn't very good. But I do see it. I mean, I think at highest we're looking at $10,000, it looks like. So we will see in this, Representative McDonald's, when we get targets, if we could squeeze $5,000 or $10,000 in. It's never easy, as you know.
I
Representative McDonald. Of course, with before that, our right, county sales tax exemption first, of course, right, Mr.
Yes.
Chair?
You've already led me down this path, Representative McDonald. I'm going to stop there. So any other members' concerns or questions? If not, Representative Petersburg, any final comments on House File 1083?
Mr. Chair, just you know, a third or fourth may be the charm, and so I appreciate the willingness to hear this committee, and I just ask for your support, and so I do renew my motion. Thank
Very
you.
Good. Representative Petersburg renews his motion to lay over House File 1083 for probable or possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Okay. So Representative Tapke is in traffic, but we are going to, there's a number of testifiers. So if someone would like to move House File 1156, Representative Beckerfin moves House File 1156. And there is an amendment, and so Representative Beckerfin would like to move the A3 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beckerfin moves the A3 amendment. And while we've got a moment here, who would, Mr. Williams or Mr. Clayman would like to, Mr. who would like to talk to, okay, Mr. Clayman, if you would talk to the A3 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, the A3 amendment makes a number of both administrative, technical, and substantive changes to the underlying bill. Just going through chronologically by line, starting at line 1.2 of the amendment. The amendment would create a provision that states that the credit, instead of being 100% of the contribution, is actually an undetermined percentage of the amount of the contribution. There is also a administrative provision in here that provides a scheme for how to administer the credit carryover when there is a new credit that the taxpayer may also take, and also clarifies what you do in any year when you can take the new credit and multiple credit carryovers. The amendment also deletes a provision allowing the credit to be taken for a taxpayer's own project for which they receive a grant or a loan under the 462A section of the bill, and so that clarifies that the taxpayer cannot get the credit for their own project. The amendment also states that it makes a clarifying change related to the recapture provisions on page 3, line 7, and states that because the credit is not recaptured, that the taxpayer cannot get a refund of that credit if it's been designated for a specific project and the specific project doesn't happen. In other words, you can't get your money back and still take the credit. There is also a sunset provision that's added to two sections of the bill. The sunset is set at tax years beginning after December 31, 2029, so 2030. The bill also on page 4 changes the set-aside percentage to 50% and changes that provision so that it applies instead of to single-family homes and cities with populations under 10,000, instead it says that 50% has to be set aside for projects serving households that are at or below 50% area median income. And then finally, there is a change to the tax expenditure purpose statement on page 5 on section 4. And so that's what the amendment does, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clayman. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Clayman. And I thought you said that the provision on the amendment on line 1.9 and 1.10 said that they couldn't donate to their own project, but I thought the limitation here is much more limited. It's referring to a state loan and grant program, so they could get other public financing through a municipality or a county or something. Is that correct?
Mr. Clayman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, yes. So the limitation, that's a good clarification, the limitation under the amendment would apply to a grant or loan that's received under Section 462A40, which is the new section of law that's created in the bill. So, but and that section is, you know, essentially how the bill works is that a taxpayer makes a contribution to the new fund in Chapter 462A, and then that new fund then can fund other projects. And so that language that you're referring to just says that the taxpayer can't get the credit for a project that's funded through that new 462A section.
Great. Thank you for clarifying that.
Thank you. Any other questions on the A3 amendment, Representative McDonald?
Not on the A3 amendment.
Okay. So any other questions on the A3 amendment? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The motion does prevail. The A3 amendment is adopted. Okay, so we're to the bill. So I think what we'll do is, Representative Howard.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Yes, are you here? In,
I am not Representative Tabke, but I am here pinch-hitting. I'm a co-author on this bill. And
do you want to offer some opening statements then?
Sure, I'll offer some very brief statements.
Very good.
You know, really this proposal, I think, is about creating an innovative way to leverage private dollars to address our statewide housing crisis. You know, this is an idea that was entered into discussion, as I understand, during the last session with a lot of good work and a lot of good bipartisan discussion, and I think it's one that really merits our attention this session as well. And with that, I'll turn it over to Lee Murphy to talk a little more depth about the bill that's before us.
In just a second, before we start, Representative McDonald, did you want to ask a question now, or did you?
I'll wait.
Okay, very good. So, welcome. If you would please state your name and present your testimony.
My name is Libby Murphy. I'm the Deputy Policy Director at Minnesota Housing Partnership. As Representative Tapke is roughly 5 minutes away at this point, I'm going to walk through. There's a handout that all of you received today to talk a little bit about the data to discuss the need. The Governor's Housing Task Force earlier this year, last year, identified a need for more than 300,000 new units by 2030 across all incomes and all types of housing. This does not include the fact that the state of Minnesota is losing roughly 2,000 units annually, and so there's a dire need for preservation. If you turn to the next slide, more than one in four households in Minnesota, both renters and homeowners, are experiencing cost burden, meaning that they are spending more than 30% of their income on housing. This has risen significantly since 2000 by 60%. And Minnesota has the highest rate of homeowners experiencing cost burden in the upper Midwest. Households of color are disproportionately affected by our housing crisis here in the state. The gap between white homeowners and homeowners of color is one of the worst in the nation. And it also is disproportionately impacting renters of color as well. Currently, only three of the top 10 most in-demand jobs in Minnesota pay enough for a full-time worker to afford a two-bedroom rent, while six of the top 10 jobs pay less than is needed to afford even a one-bedroom apartment. Over the next decade, the top five positions with the most projected job openings all earn median incomes of less than $25,000 per year. Collectively, these positions are projected to gain roughly 135,000 employees. And as you can see from the chart, those employees would not be able to afford a one-bedroom or two-bedroom apartment in the state. In every county in the state, the average renter would need to earn at least $2,600 and as much as $25,000 more per year to afford a two-bedroom apartment. Nearly half of all counties have an annual gap that exceeds $10,000 between what an average renter income is and what they would need to afford a two-bedroom apartment in that county. While two-bedroom apartments are out of reach for most Minnesotans, even one-bedroom apartments are out of reach to the average income renter in 41% of Minnesota counties. And even the median income renter would need an 8% raise to afford rent for a modest two-bedroom apartment. The Tax Credit Contribution Fund asks everyone to recognize our urgent crisis and brought in the coalition of stakeholders to make this a community-wide solution. The fund will encourage local businesses and neighbors to invest in their community by creating housing opportunities. The program is capitalized by contributions from taxpayers that have state income, corporate or insurance premium tax liabilities, and in exchange for contributions to affordable housing, participating taxpayers would receive a tax credit against their state income tax liability. The program relies on taxpayer support to provide low-cost financing to developers of affordable housing. The program is simple, it's flexible, it leverages. This is a program modeled after a program in North Dakota that leveraged $5 for every dollar the state invested. It's easy for businesses and individuals to participate, and it boosts local economies. Investments in local housing projects pay for themselves. We know that multiple research studies have found that building affordable rental and owner-occupied homes generates millions in local income, in local taxes, local spending, and other revenue each year. This, we've worked with Minnesota Housing and DEED to identify that the Tax Credit Contribution Fund could create 350 new units for every $25 million invested, or make 1,000 units more affordable, and one of our testifiers will speak to that issue. And would generate 700 new jobs annually, both direct jobs, indirect jobs, and induced jobs.
Thank you. Ms. Murphy, thank you so much. So we have eight testifiers on the list. I know there might be more from the audience. So as I call you up, I'm going to give you about 2 minutes, if you can try to make your comments in about 2 minutes, because I want to also leave time for discussion here by members. So I've got Ms. Larson. And then Mayor Williams is on deck. So please welcome. Please state your name for the committee, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee members for the opportunity to testify. I'm here, obviously, in support of the Tax Credit Contribution Fund for Affordable Housing. My name is Sarah Larson. I'm a partner at Landon Group. I have 20 years of experience working on all types of affordable housing development. Landon Group is an affordable housing development consultant. We work with clients to bring these developments to fruition, both in the metro and in greater Minnesota. But for public funds and financing, the creation of new affordable housing will not occur. Public funds leverage critical participation from private partners. All of the 2,500 units of housing in which Landon Group has been involved in has relied on funding from multiple sources. Unfortunately, the state is not a reliable partner today in affordable housing development. Last year, Landon Group applied to MHFA with 6 viable projects. Only one received funding. In 2017, we applied with 7 projects. Again, only one was funded. Of the 20 developments in our current pipeline, we are not including funding from the state in over half. This is not because the developments do not meet MHFA goals or that they're not viable. It's simply because MHFA does not have enough resources for us to believe that the state will be able to provide any level of funding within the next 3 years. When a development does not receive funding from the state, sometimes the developer abandons affordable housing at the site completely. Sometimes the developer increases the rent levels in order to bridge the relatively small amount of funding the state could have provided. For instance, it adds on average $20,000 a unit in cost to reduce the rent from 60% AMI rent levels to 50% AMI rent levels. So increasing that rent level solves that problem if the state doesn't have funding. Sometimes they just simply extend the timeline to seek the remaining funding from other sources. In these instances, the cost to produce the housing increases year after year, and the amount of needed funding just simply increases. This proposed reliable source of funding from the state would be an important tool to produce more affordable housing. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. And Mayor Williams, and on deck is Ms. Rivers. Mayor, welcome. Mm-hmm. Please state your name and please proceed.
Well, thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm here to support the Tax Credit Contribution Fund for Affordable Housing. I'm Janet Williams, the Mayor of Savage. I've been the mayor for 12 years, and prior to that, I was elected to the council in 2003. I'm a member of the Regional Council of Mayors, affiliate chair of NAMI for Scott County, and just completed serving as chair of the nominating committee for the Metropolitan Council. Our city is committed to life cycle housing, so affordable housing is important to our economic vitality. I tell my constituents that we, in capital letters, need affordable housing in our city for our first-time teachers, the community services officers, the workers in our daycare, our school bus drivers, checkout clerks in the stores, and wait persons in the restaurants. In 2014, we opened our first workforce housing, and actually the first in the county. This was accomplished by cobbling together many types of source resources, and of course having the NIMBYs make their protests, having to call the police during an altercation at our council meeting when people would not listen to our facts and emotions took over. Our second house for workforce housing was opening this year, and our third one is ready but is in need of some funding. We've accomplished this with creativity through our many partners. We've had Metropolitan Council Livable Communities grants, CDA funding, some federal tax credits, city loans, city-provided land at a reduced cost, and the list goes on and on and on. We can't do this alone, and that's why I'm here. The state provides help to the business who come to the city, to our cities. How about some help with affordable housing for the workers? And I feel this is a creative plan. Another tool in our toolbox would really help. We need the state to be a partner in providing affordable housing for our community members. We have an affordable housing crisis. We need the state to partner with the private sector and local government in creating solutions like the tax credit contribution fund. Thank you for your time.
Mayor Williams, thank you so much for your testimony. Ms. Rivers and Mr. Moriarty is next. And before Ms. Rivers begins, welcome Representative Tapke.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Becker Finn has moved your bill, and we've also moved your amendment. So we're now in the testimony stage. So
thank you very much.
And thank you. I see goodies here coming around. Thank you so much. So, Ms. Rivers, please proceed.
Hi, my name is Marie Rivers. I own and operate Sven's Clogs. We make Swedish clogs in Chisago City. I'm on the City Council, the Economic Development Authority, and the Chisago Lakes Area Housing Task Force. Chisago County has had a housing study done, and the local areas in the Chisago Lakes area, all the cities have got together and done a workbook so that when developers do come into our area, they don't have to go through any of the zoning. We've found different places that are suitable for affordable housing. I work side by side with my employees on a daily basis, and I hear the stories of how they go through trying to find decent and affordable housing. The places that are available are expensive and many times not kept up very well. And we live in an area with the lakes are all around us. And year by year, the land available for developing workforce housing goes up in value. And eventually, it makes it out of reach for the average worker to obtain a safe place to live in the communities that they work. We need some kind of incentive so that the developers will want to invest in workforce housing. For them, everything comes down to the bottom line of if it's profitable. If not, they won't invest in our community. It makes it difficult in this competitive market for employees to want to stay working in the area when they can't find a place to live. Eventually, if they do move far away to find less expensive housing or any kind of housing, they just find a job closer to where they live, where their children go to school. And once again, we lose our employees. It also affects the fact that new businesses coming into the area, bringing their own employees, they have no place to live. What's the chance of hiring local people without housing? There won't be any employees living there to hire. I try to help my employees to know that there's low interest loans or programs for zero down for first time home buyers, but then we actually have to have the homes for them to buy to stay in the area. At the end of the day, we all just want a place to go home to be able to provide a safe and stable place for our families to live. I would like to thank the committee for consideration of the Tax Credit Contribution Fund for affordable housing. We so desperately need it. I've been working on this in our little city of Chisago for the last 8 years, and it's working so close to my employees. It just breaks my heart to see that some of them want to move on in life. They can't afford to even get married, have a family, and live anywhere. So their lives are always on hold. You've got five people living in one house because that's the only way they can make it. And I hope that... I don't know what everyone's economic, the money, their problem that they have, but for a person that used to be a single mother, it's very difficult to look your child in the eye and say you don't have a home to go home to. So I think we really need to do something about all of this because everyone else gets to go home to their home, and when you don't have a place to go, it's really difficult. So I hope you take that into consideration when you think about affordable housing.
Ms. Rivers, thank you so much. Mr. Moriarty and Ms. Swift is on deck. Please state your name and please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Denny Moriarty, and I am from Scott County, Minnesota, and I spent my life not seeing homeless people. Tonight, Mary Beth Shin of Vanderbilt University did a study on homelessness in Minnesota, and she tells us that tonight in the seven-county metropolitan area, there will be 6,000, actually over 6,000 homeless people. And of those 6,000, 2,000 of them will be children, and half of those will be under the age of five. In the seven-county Twin City metropolitan area, there are 100,000 families who are paying 50% or more of their income for housing. That means there are 100,000 families who are just a broken-down car or a sickness away from being homeless. If you want to rent a modest two-bedroom apartment in Scott and Carver County, you better earn $18.60 an hour. If you earn minimum wage, then you better be prepared to work 78 hours a week in order to pay for your housing. For the last 4 years, I've been a volunteer in a program called Families Moving Forward, where you go, the homeless, we take care of four homeless families at a time, and they go faith community to faith community. And we were hosting in a small Presbyterian church in my little community called Belle Plaine, Minnesota. And the Presbyterian church was built in 1865 in the time of Lincoln. And we hosted the families in the basement of the church, and the basement had cement stone walls. And it didn't have rafters, so we had to fasten sheets. It didn't have rooms, and we fastened sheets. It was an area about as big as the area under which you're sitting that we had these four families. We fastened sheets to divide the four families into separate areas. And we got them settled, and on the third day of hosting, I received a call, and I was at the church at the time I received the call, and I was asked by Families Moving Forward, which is the program I volunteer for, can you take a fifth family? And I'm talking to these people on the phone in the church. And we have four families in an area this big with bed sheets separating them. And I said, I don't know. And one of the members of the church came up to me and said, we've got to do this. And then a woman came up to me who was one of the mothers. And she had two little children, and she was homeless. And she said to me, if you need more room, I'll give them half of my space. Now, and I apologize for being emotional, I have had people say to me, why aren't these people like us? Well, you know, they are like us. But sometimes they're better than us. Thank you.
Mr. Moriarty, thank you so much. Ms. Swift?
Hey, good morning.
And then Mr. Borchard is on deck. So,
good morning.
Please state your name.
Thank you to the chair and the committee members. My name is Danielle Swift, and if you would engage with me a little bit this morning, just by a show of hands, I'm curious how many of the committee members have experienced homelessness firsthand. Just want to get a feel for how much of the choir I'm preaching to. Okay. All right. I am currently a policy advocate with MICA. I am also an anti-displacement organizer at the Frogtown Neighborhood Association. I'm here to speak today in favor of the tax credit contribution fund, House File Number 1156. I'm someone who works on the ground directly with community. I'm a door knocker, and my job is to activate community around housing and other issues, but mostly housing. I do what I do out of the love for people and my love and love for my community, but I also do this work for myself and for my children, Elijah and London. We are a part of our community, and we are not excluded to the issues that our community face. The desire and the need to be safe and healthy at home is not a luxury, but a basic human need, just like food and water. So I pour my everything into opening up housing here in Minnesota and St. Paul. Despite my credentials, experience, and passion, I still found myself couch hopping this past year between leases, aka homeless. So just this past year. I had to vacate a substandard duplex with a malfunctioning furnace. I couldn't continue to justify paying rent where we didn't have heat in the dead of winter. And the rental market was and still is harsh. You got to have the first month's and last month's rent plus a security deposit to move in. And if you make three times the rent, even if you have all of those, the less than 3% vacancy rate still makes it very difficult to find a home.
there has to be an intervention. And the selfless work of many hands, including my hands and including your hands, is that intervention. But the work has to be resourced. It has to be resourced for communities like mine, and it has to be resourced for people like me. I thank you for your time and your consideration, and I hope that you will all stand in solidarity with me to support House File Number 1156. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Burchard.
Mr. Chair.
And then, what? Yes, Representative Papke.
Just ask just a question real quick, Mr. Chair. That's the end of the testifiers that we had brought today to talk about things, and we have two other folks who are here to support the bill as well, but we'd also like to have a little bit of discussion about the bill here today, so I just want to know how you'd like to move forward.
Well, we're going to hear the testifiers.
Perfect.
And then we'll open that up to
Beautiful.
Discussion. So thank you, sir. Representative Papke. So please proceed. State your name for the...
Mr. Chair and members, Steve Borkhardt. I'm the director of the Coalition for Rochester Area Housing. In my role, I've been charged with creating a local housing trust fund, largely as a fundraising, local philanthropy from local individuals and businesses. I've been in this position now for 3 years. I didn't come from this line of work, so I've had to learn from people that have been doing it their entire career. You've heard from a number of people that have talked about homelessness, and that always really tugs at our heartstrings. And you've heard a lot of the data, and I know you've been inundated by data. When I hit the street 3 years ago in Rochester to speak to the business community about raising a local trust fund to supplement the state and federal sources of funding necessary to create housing for people at 50% of area median income, which in Olmsted County is about $35,000 a year, I learned that the community, particularly the leadership of the business community, wasn't ready to contribute for that kind of cause. They did not yet believe that market forces would not eventually resolve this issue on its own. I learned that I had to do better community communication and education. Then what I've learned over the last 3 years since I've been out there doing that, during that period of time, our business community has come to the realization that the economic market forces of supply and demand are not going to create a product to the level of people that are making $35,000 to $40,000 to even $50,000 a year for rental in Olmsted County. And I've learned that my task is much more than just being a fundraiser. I need to change a culture. Everybody sitting in this room right now has been able to take for granted for your entire life that if you worked, particularly if you worked full-time, the housing market was going to supply a product suitable to your means. If you didn't make a lot, it wasn't going to be opulent. If you made a lot, it could be fabulous. That's no longer the case. And that is a hard change for people to come to understand. In Olmsted County right now, on $50,000 a year gross annual household income, you're going to have difficulty finding a good place to rent. You're going to have difficulty purchasing a house on up to $65,000 to $70,000 of gross annual household income. You've had a lot of the data. I won't repeat it. We are on the verge of telling an entire generation that they will not have the personal wealth-building tool of homeownership available to them. It's time to change the culture. Everybody needs to get in on this, the faith community, the business community. We will see a ceiling to economic development if people do not have a place to live. So I support this bill, and I hope you can support it also. Thank you
very much. Senator Cascaden, welcome.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. It's Commissioner Cascaden these days.
Commissioner now.
Welcome. I am a member of the Elvis County Board of Commissioners. I've been a member of the board for 6 years. I also serve on the Coalition for Greater Rochester Area Housing, the Leadership Council. I serve on the Olmsted County Housing and Redevelopment Authority. I serve on the First Homes Board, which is run by the Area Foundation and builds single-family homes and has a community land trust. I have served last year on the Task Force on Housing, and I serve on a Southeastern Minnesota Together work group that's looking at our workforce shortage. And, of course, you can't deal with workforce without looking at housing. And so while I'm not going to repeat some of the things you've heard about the impact of housing on our lowest income Minnesotans, I really want to call out to you that we in Minnesota have had a competitive advantage on our workforce side. We have had a high quality of life, we've had good education, and we've had affordable housing. When we really do the numbers, the task force that met last year, we have a very serious undersupply of housing that we have to make up. And I just heard Neil Kashkaria from the Federal Reserve at an economic summit in Rochester earlier this fall, and he said what I believe. Government is not going to solve this problem. There's no way that we can have government be the solution for the full range of housing issues that we have. And we really do need the private sector to step up. I recently served on a panel, and I never get his name right, Rick Tonvet from DigiKey. That's a Minnesota corporation that grew from a $2 billion corporation to a $3 billion corporation with area in Thief River Falls because of the investment you made in their plant. And now they talk about the investment that they have to make in housing. So they're doing housing subsidies even for entry-level workers, which you said they didn't do in the past, but they are now. But they aren't really, they're having trouble attracting the developers, and they're not investing in housing. They have an undersupply problem. Down in my part of the state, in Dodge County, the county over next to Olmsted, about 16,000 people, has an Oshkosh manufacturing plant called McNelius. McNelius does not have enough housing for their workers. They are investing in providing temporary housing in residential hotels. But that doesn't help their bottom line, and it doesn't really help their employee turnover. And it certainly doesn't contribute those hotels are in Olmsted County, and it doesn't contribute to Dodge County's tax base. And so we really need this tax credit because it isn't going to be just about providing government subsidies to create more housing. We need public investment. We need private investment. We need employers to be able to build the kind of housing their own workforce needs and make it available to them. We need every tool that we can make available to engage the public sector at the state level and at the local level, philanthropy at the state level and at the local level, and the private sector at the state level and the local level. And this bill will help advance that.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. I have one more person on the list, Representative Dorman, former representative. And then if anyone else from the audience would like to testify on House File 1156 as amended, if you would please come down. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Dorman. I'm the executive director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. I wouldn't say we're opposed to the bill. We'd like to see some modifications to it if this bill goes forward for several reasons. And I'll be brief, Mr. Chair, but just for a bit of history, our organization worked on a workforce housing tax credit that you were a co-author of for several years using a very similar structure, patterned after North Dakota and a project in Iowa. And I'm glad to see that some of the people that opposed that saying it would not work have now come around saying, boy, that will work. The mechanism does work. The tax credit part of this does work. There's no question. It's a question of what do you want to do with the money. That's your job. I would suggest to you that in many ways this bill adds more money to the Challenge Grant program. And I understand that because we designed our tax credit program. One thing rolling around the back of my head was escape the Jobs and Economic Development Committee, get over here where there's a bigger budget. But it should be something different. If you want to add more money to the Challenge Grant program, my personal view, this would be the wrong committee, but I understand the need because the need is certainly out there. Just a little difference between the bill that many of you co-authored and this. It's not really a targeted quite as much as ours. To go to the, in Greater Minnesota, we have a little bit different need than is being expressed by a lot of folks here in the metro area, but looked like the provision or the set-aside for communities under 10,000 was removed, but I'd argue that might have been a little bit low anyway, because when you get into communities like mine, Albert Lea, or communities smaller, Austin is a little bit bigger. They haven't seen market rate apartments built in over 40 years. And so it is a huge economic development issue for these mid-sized communities in greater Minnesota. And so if this moves forward and you're going to do it, I would think about addressing that. And the cost drivers overall. If you look at the MFHA scoring criteria, it's cost per unit unless they've changed it is well down the list, and that drives your cost per unit up. I think that as a legislative body, the question should be, you know, where's that line between much nicer units and more units? And I think that that's a debate that the legislature ought to address. The other thing I'd highlight is in Subdivision 2, it's 100% credit. I'll be quick, it's 100% credit. And the last thing I'll mention, and then I'll cease, if you look at lines 4.8 to 4.10, the dollars aren't divided, the units are divided. And I would say that is a inadvertently impacts Greater Minnesota. In the metropolitan area, you see a lot more blended buildings with higher costs per unit. That's a choice that folks are making up here in this area. Don't do that with dollars. It really should go to Greater Minnesota. So I'd like to see the our organization would like to see a little different split in split of dollars, not just units. Mr. Chair, I'll stop.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Representative Norman. Anyone else would like to testify for or against House File 1156 as amended? Seeing none. Members, questions, comments? Representative McDonald, thank you for your patience.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on for the author. I'm just looking, if you could clarify for me, the tax credit is, it says in Sections 3, the allocation that the taxpayer may indicate the contribution intended for a specific project, that's fine. And then if the project does not happen, that contribution then is returned back to the taxpayer. And that's in line 2.23 to 2.27. But then in some Section 5, in recapture, it's stated that if the grant or loan that's made for the project is canceled or recaptured by the department, the agency is not required to return it to the contribution of the taxpayer. So either I'm reading that wrong or I'm not understanding that correctly.
Representative Papke or Mr. Klayman? Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, the provision allowing recapture relates to the project that's funded through the fund. In the new sections that are created here for the fund in Section 462A. And then the other section relates to the tax credit. So the idea there is that if the funds have been designated for a specific project, but then that project is, say, canceled or subject to recapture under the grant or loan program, then the funds go back into that, the money goes back into that fund, and it could be used for another project. But because the taxpayer already made a contribution to the fund, they continue to be entitled to receive the credit. So in other words, you could designate it for a specific project. If that doesn't work out, it'll get used for another project, but you don't lose the credit. So that's how those two provisions work together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Clement. Then, what about the sections, the 2.23, where it says it returns the taxpayer, returns the contribution of the taxpayer? Is that my incorrect in reading or that section?
2.23.
About 2.26, where it says the agency must return the contribution to the taxpayer in a timely manner. Is that after the project has been canceled or after he donated it and the fund was recaptured? Or I'm just...
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I believe that refers to the $25 million cap on the credit. So if there aren't any credits that can be allocated because we're over the cap, then at that point, then the contributions are returned to the taxpayer so that they don't end up making a contribution, expecting a credit, and then not be able to get one because there have already been an exceeding of the limit.
I understand.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you very much. And then just real quickly, I did have some concerns regarding rural Greater Minnesota. And in the bill, it says that the commissioner may, if all possible, ensure that funds are used in Greater Minnesota. And I think that should be tightened up, if at all possible. It's so vague. And I've seen that in the 8 years here where we're disproportionately some of those funds and grants through deed and many other programs have been Greater Minnesota has not taken advantage of that or been taken advantage of.
Representative Tapp.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative McDonald, that's one of the things I think is the beauty of this this bill is it allows market forces to help tell where that money should be going. So this is in my opinion, is a much better way to go than just directly appropriating money and saying 30, 50, 70% should go to whatever type of housing and geographic regions and those kinds of things. But let's market forces say that, hey, we really value and need affordable housing in our community, and this is a tool and a mechanism to say that we need to have X type of project in whatever city that may be. And so it allows the private market to say, this is what we value and this is where we want to go with things. And so within this $50 million of money, we have DigiKey that says they really value and want to have their employees invest in affordable housing in this project in our community. It allows market forces to say where that money should go and how it should be utilized, as opposed to just directly appropriating $50 million to an agency to manufacture and kind of create that demand and understanding where the market is. This lets direct market forces say what should happen with this investment.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that just kind of, you kind of touched on a little bit of that section C, that 4.8 to 4.10. You know, would the committee be open to, you know, having that conversation? I understand this bill is being laid over possible inclusion, but that might be a good conversation to have for especially that aligned 4.9 to nonpartisan staff, that equal number of, rather than housing units, just switch that to dollars are financed in the metropolitan area, you know, so that, you know, maybe there would be, you know, because if you think about number of units, my guess is it would be a lot cheaper to do, you know, units in rural Minnesota versus the, you know, so if you're going by unit, a unit in the Twin Cities would be much more expensive, but so we could potentially spread that out a little bit more, stretch those dollars a little bit, I think would be a great potential change to the bill. And then just kind of a general question to the author, you know, how long must these units be, you know, quote-unquote affordable? And then I have a follow-up to that.
Okay, Representative Tapkin.
Yeah, thank you. These are units, so I think we've talked a little bit about it today, but hopefully everyone understands the area median income and those types of things as to what qualifies as affordable. And this money that goes into this tax credit is a snapshot in time. So this creates, we know for a fact that we need 300,000 affordable units in the state of Minnesota in the next 10 years. We know that. That's why we have the sunset in this bill. That's why we have the urgency put around getting this moving. And so units is where we need to focus, because the units is what delivers the product to the market. And so that's I would be obviously open to anything the committee would like to do with regard to units versus dollars, but I think that units are the end product that we're really, that's the goal that we're trying to get to with this bill, is where that is going. And Libby, do you want to add more?
We're running out of time here, so yep. Representative Swazinski, if you, your follow-up question, then we'll, yep. If you've got some closing comments, you can just have Ms. Murphy.
Ask it offline.
Sounds good.
Representative, I can answer that question about the affordability term if you want.
We'll come back to that. Representative Leslegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this was for the author. Why is this better as a tax credit rather than a spending bill?
Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Leslegard. I believe it's a much better way to go, because it, as I was saying earlier, it allows market forces to say where money should be spent and where investments should go, as opposed to just a direct appropriation to an agency.
Representative Joaquin.
I just thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I was late. And Representative Tapke, thank you for bringing the bill. I think this is a really great blend of market forces, local control, public-private partnerships, and being able to pull in money that might not be being invested right now. Mm-hmm. As one of your testifiers said, we can't solve this huge problem by government alone. So it's really bringing in the private sector, and I just wanted to say thank you.
Representative Wall?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and the amendments kind of changed the proposal, because originally it was 100%. You got, so it was the most favored donation I've seen in this committee. But I do have a concern about a precedent in the tax committee, because every section of our budget is underfunded and can bring great witnesses to why we have waiting lists on sliding fee child care, and then we hear from the same employers who can't find housing for their workers, that they can't find workers because the kids aren't being cared for and there isn't a slot. And so we have a lot of undermet needs, and we tend to meet those through the appropriations process, where proposals compete with each other. They have to document that their need is greater in committee. Community A versus Community B, they have to show that they're cost-effective. And so I have concerns about using this as a tax approach. But I also listened really carefully to our witnesses. And overwhelmingly, over and over and over again, the word was affordable housing. A couple mentioned workforce housing, but this is not targeted at the greatest need for affordable housing, which is people at 20 to 40% of median income. This bill says 50% will go to 50% of median, the greater of statewide or area median income. I've never seen the statewide or area on a housing bill before, but the rest can go up to 80% of state or area median income for rental. That is a pretty well-paid renter, or 115% of the state or area median income from households. And so I think if we're really going to respond to the issues of homelessness, if we're going to respond to the low-wage workers who can't meet their basic housing needs with the state stepping up, I really think we need to target it at the place where the private sector cannot go. It cannot go to 20 to 40% of poverty. It can make it at 80% and 115%. And I think if we're going to move forward, I would really want to look at targeting much, much more specifically. But the Housing Committee is much better at knowing these numbers than we are. So my first preference would be to continue to support efforts within the Housing Committee. The governor just recommended a major investment in bonding to help with that. So I think we're just going to have to balance things out.
Thank you very much. Representative Fabian, then we're going to go to closing comments. So
thank
Representative
you, Mr.
Fabian,
Chair.
If you could please be short.
Yes, I will. I think we'd be remiss, and Representative Loeffler mentioned child care and so forth, but even related to housing, the governor's task force put out the report some time ago about how regulations add cost to housing, and they add cost to child care, and they add cost to doing business and so forth. I think in some place in this whole conversation, if we leave out regulations as a way to make housing more accessible, more affordable to people, we would be not doing our job. So I just want to put that on the table.
Thank you.
And I'm sure you have plenty of ideas there too, Mr. Chair. Thank you
very much, Representative Fabian. Representative Tappy, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, everyone. I, again, apologize for being late. But to a couple of things that were said, this bill is not a bill intended to solve all the problems. It's intended to solve some of the problems and help market forces push that. And to get down into those really 20, 30% AMI-type projects takes triple, quadruple the amount of money we have here. And everyone, child care, education, health care, all of those things do not exist as issues except for the fact that people have to have a home to live in. And so this helps to bring people help. This is a project that will help to add more homes, hit the $300,000 units that we must have in the state of Minnesota in the next 10 years to give people a home so that we can adequately start to approach and address other issues within child care, health care, those kinds of things. So thank you very much for the discussion today. We, in the amendment, as it was discussed, we changed from the one-to-one to have that discussion with the committees as it moves forward as to what the best number is to be for the tax credit. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tappy, thank you for bringing this forward. Representative Becker-Finn renews her motion to lay over House File 1156 as amended for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. And members, thank you so much, and we are adjourned.